All right, hey everybody, good morning. As John Palfrey just said, for anyone who caught it, sort of forget everything you learned about format yesterday. The goal today is not to be about panels. The goal today is to be about conversations. And though there may be different people at the front of the room, try not to take that too seriously. The goal is going to be for us to all be engaged in sort of an ongoing dialogue.
And one other thing, there are some participants in this room, Mohammed and Omar from Iraq. They would prefer not to have photographs of themselves put on people's blogs. You can talk to them later about the reasons why, but please respect their wishes on this. You can blog the fact that they're here, but please don't post photographs of them here on the web.
But other than that one security issue, everything else is fully on the record, fully bloggable. We would be disappointed if the rest of the conference didn't get blogged.
So yes.
With that one completely understandable exception, otherwise it's fully on the record.
We hope it will be.
Pictures of Ethan,
Be
this side, Jeff.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty much it for procedural. If we didn't print one of these for you in advance, please feel free to make your own as creatively as you would like. That's great. Then we can kind of call on people and know everybody's name. We know a lot of people in the room, but not everybody. But one of the reasons why we decided to run this has to do with both of our concerns about media and about communication and the conversation that does or does not happen cross borders. And I'm a journalist by training. I've spent a lot of time overseas, and I've become increasingly concerned, especially in the past several years, about the real gulf that's widening between Americans and people in the rest of the world in terms of how people view the world, just where this globe should be going, who should be running it, how and why. And the international media is not doing anything to bridge this gulf or facilitate a conversation. In fact, in some ways, it's perhaps exacerbating the gulf. And that's one reason why I got very excited about blogs and the potential for blogs. When I saw people blogging from Iraq and telling their own personal stories, their own personal perspectives about what was happening there, and the ability for ordinary people in the United States or somewhere else to engage in a conversation without having to go through governments, without having to go through reporters, to have that conversation is critical. And the ability to go to a blog and get information about what's going on in a place that isn't being covered by the mainstream media is very important. And to get the firsthand perspective of an ordinary person living in a particular country, the ability for Indians and Pakistanis, for instance, to have a dialogue in cyberspace about their own individual concerns without having to have somebody raise money and get on planes to meet with one another. Very important. But there's a lot of conversations that aren't being joined. For instance, Chinese bloggers talk a lot amongst themselves. They're not talking very much with people in the rest of the world. There are reasons for this. There are tools reasons. There are language reasons. So we want to discuss how we can really extend this conversation that's starting in pockets of cyberspace through blogs, how to make it broader, how to perhaps make it more systematic so people can find the conversations they want to have, how to enable cross-cultural, cross-linguistic communication that hasn't been happening enough in this increasingly troubled world. So I'll turn it over to Ethan with that.
So if Rebecca's the bad news, I'm the good news. And I don't mean that in any sense other than what we're talking about in general. Rebecca's generally better news than I am. What we're really trying to do today, if one of the themes for yesterday was the theme of skepticism, this question of whether the internet really is changing everything, I think to some large extent this room is, if not a skepticism-free zone, at least a skepticism-light zone. A lot of the people in this room are actively engaged in the process of trying to figure out how to change the world through the work that we're doing online. A huge number of the people in this room are already doing what Rebecca and I have started talking about as bridge blogging. And what I mean by that, and I'm sort of stealing part of Hoder's three-part analogy yesterday. Hoder talked about blogs as windows, blogs as bridges, and blogs as cafes. Blogs as windows can give you a chance to look into someone else's life. Blogs as cafes can give a whole bunch of people a chance to come together and have political discussion. I want to drill down on this notion of blogs as bridges and the idea that blogs can provide a connection between people in a radically different society and allow people across a different gap to talk to one another. Whether that's people who are in the military talking with civilians, whether that's people in Iraq talking with people in the US, whether it's people in China talking with people in Europe, these are all bridges that blogs have the capability to build. And as Hoder pointed out yesterday, it's not just between nations. It can be between ethnic groups. It can be between ages. It can be between genders. It can be between religions. But these are all the bridges that we're interested in building. And the reason that we got interested in spending a day on this was a sense that something really big is starting to happen. There's a lot of us doing this work on our own. We're doing it individually. We're doing it in small groups. There are groups coming together like Alex Steffen's group World Changing, which are bringing together bloggers and 20 different bloggers to sort of unite around some common themes. There are people who are putting together communities, Ori, who's working throughout Kenya to get a bunch of Kenyan bloggers together. There are people who are already bringing folks together. And what I'm really curious about is whether, to some extent, we find ourselves becoming a movement. And I don't mean a movement in the sense of we're all going to print up T-shirts and develop a secret handshake and, you know, have marching orders at the end of the day, although I'm open to the secret handshake if anyone's got good ideas for it. But in the sense that we're all in this together to one extent or another. And I'm hoping that by talking about this and talking about building new tools, building some institutions, building a sense that we're working on this jointly, we may actually be able to turn this into something of a movement. So that's our goal for the day, and it's a lofty goal. And if all we get out of it is some really good conversations, I think we'll be pretty happy. But what I'm hoping we'll get out of the day is some sense that we're all in it together and some sense of what that it ends up being. Or Joey, who will also help you out.
Hi, everyone. I think that the main reason I started this blog, like the model, was to bridge the gap between two cultures. And particularly here, I'm speaking about Iraq and America. You know, there is actually a gap between those two cultures. They are from different places. They have different languages, different traditions. And what made that even worse, I mean, what made that gap even deeper was the role of the mainstream media, and especially I'm here talking about the Arabic media, which had a very bad influence on Iraqis. So the main point about blogs is that they allow interaction between the authors and the readers, and between the readers themselves, readers from different cultures, because the direction of the conversation in blogs is different than the direction of the conversation in journalism or in TV. There is no, it's like from people to people. It's not like from one institute or from one journalist to a bunch of people. It allows interaction. The author of the blog, the blogger, would throw out an idea, and well, the readers from both sides of the gap, let's say, will exchange their ideas. Mainly, I'm here talking about the comment section. I think this is the core of blogs, the comment section, because it will help people from both sides to take a look at how people from the other side think about this idea. So they have, there will be three points of view. The point of view from the blogger himself, from the left side, and from the right side. And when people read each other's responses, there will be kind of a better understanding at the end of the discussion. It will help people understand how they look at each other, not like, you know, the media talks for the people. So they try to talk on behalf of the people. They think that they are representative of the people. But here is the main point, is that in blogs, it's from between the people themselves. There are no barriers. There are no filters. They exchange their ideas so directly. I think I have one short example. I don't want to talk too much about this. But there is a small, short story that I posted once on my blog. It was about one of my uncles and his cousin. His cousin is a teenager, and he had this, he was kind of brainwashed by one of the radical clerics in his neighborhood that preaches in a mosque there. His life has changed dramatically after the liberation of Iraq. But he didn't realize that. He had hatred in his heart towards America. He saw me once blogging and responding to readers from America. He said, "How can you be friends with those people? They're our enemies." I said, "Okay, let's take a look at how your life was before those, what you call them, enemies came to your country and after that." I asked him to allow me to write something about his story, about his life before and after. And I said, "Take a look at how those people will respond to this story." He said, "Okay." I wrote the article with my brother. And 2 days later, he came and he saw a couple hundred comments from Americans, from British people, from different places of the world. And all of those comments were encouraging, were supportive. None of them contained any bit of hatred. Actually, he couldn't admit it that he changed his attitude because, you know, he's a stubborn teenager. He said, "Okay, maybe I don't hate them, but I don't like them." Okay. And he left me, and I got a phone call on my cell phone. He didn't have a cell phone before that. Okay. A couple of months later, his father bought him a car. And I said, "Were you able to get a car 2 years ago?" He said, "No." I said, "Okay. Now, I'll give you another example. I'll post a picture for you in your car. And let's see how people outside, how people in America, how people in Europe will respond to this picture." And believe me, at this point, after the comments and the responses he got, he almost cried. I just want to add one last thing, that if I visit America a year and a half ago, maybe, before I started this blog, I would have felt like a stranger. But this time, I feel like home because I am surrounded by a group of good friends. And I think that's the greatest gift I can ever think of about. Thank you.
I didn't find any difficulties by understand others thousands of miles away from me. In spite of the difference in language and tradition, I write in a simple English, but I think everybody understands what I mean. And I found through blogging that we have many things, we share many things, and media try to show only the difference between the groups and countries, but really human beings have many, many things to share. I didn't find any difficulties to express myself through blogging. And here in blogging, I learned from my readers as they accept my thoughts, I accept their thoughts. And I think through blogging, we can spread love more than we can spread hate. What pushed me to start blogging is really I saw through the media that they just want to create hate by concentrate on some issue that maybe represent only few or minority of people. But I have a different story, and many of Iraqi people agree with me. For example, I read yesterday in a newspaper here in the state a topic about an American soldier punch a prisoner in jail. That's true, and maybe this soldier represents himself, not the American army or the American people, for sure. But daily I see every day in Iraq that thousands of people shake hands with the troops, and believe me, they still wave to the troops on the road till now. But no one will put that as a topic. They put just an individual act, and they consider it as that represent the Iraqi or the American people. So I think through blogging we can spread love, and I think we are making history. And thank you.
So I want to encourage people to take some time to ask Mohammed and Omar some questions about what's gone on. And I don't know if anyone wants to lead off with a question. Otherwise, I've got about half a dozen of them. Anyone want to grab the mic before I jump in and grab the mic?
Very simple question. Why Iraq the Model? Why did you call the blog this way?
Iraq will be a model for the region, I mean the Middle East region and the world. We suffer a lot under Saddam regime. And now, after liberation, Iraqi people are trying to build a free, democratic Iraq, which will be example for the others who are still suffering under dictatorship regimes in Arabic and Muslim region. And I'm sure the Iraqi people have the ability and they are well qualified to practice their freedom and give a good example to other societies in the region. And maybe we will be a model for a new world that to overcome the difference between the difference between people and religious and ethnic group. So I think Iraq will be a model one day. Maybe it's long and hard way, but I think we will win because we put our feet on the right way.
So the question back here from Warwick, I think?
Yes. Actually, I just wanted some basic statistics on how many people in Iraq really have access to the internet and have the capability to take part in this conversation.
I traveled in many cities in Iraq, and I believe that every Iraqi citizen now can have access to the internet. I've been working in Basra for about a year in a small clinic that is practically in the marshes. And a month or 6 weeks ago, I found a new internet cafe operating in the marshes, providing fast and convenient internet service there. And I found that people were standing in lines waiting for their turn to use the internet. So practically, I think if an Iraqi citizen wants to have access to the internet, he won't find a problem at all.
So do you have a blog with your own language?
No, actually, no. But the thing that we are going to demonstrate later today, I think it's the Arabic blogging tool. I think this will help and allow more Iraqi and Arabic writers to start their own blogs, because there are some technical difficulties in creating a blog in Arabic on the available blogging tools that are present now.
Okay, so my question is, I understand that we all talking about
blog as a window to the world. However, I think because of language barriers that there are maybe the window is just a one-way window. I talked a phenomenon in UC Berkeley this year that many of us, including me, blogging in English for the Western world. However, we seldom blog in our own language, and the Western world cannot understand us with our own language because they cannot read our language. How do you think about
it? Yeah, I think you are correct here, but a one-way window is better than nothing.
So let me actually flag this as sort of one of the huge issues that we should be talking about today. Because one of the things that we're starting to see around bridge blogging, we're starting to see some pioneers standing up and blogging in English so that they can be understood by a world audience. We've also got some great counterexamples. Hoder's counterexample is a leading one of people standing up blogging in Persian, but the problem being that it's very hard for those conversations to expand beyond Iran. And Ori's got a perspective on this as well, because we're now starting to see the rise of Kiswahili bloggers. And if you think that there aren't a lot of Persian speakers out there on the net, there's also not a lot of Kiswahili speakers out there on the net. So one of the big questions that starts coming into play is, are there ways we can solve this through translation? Are there ways we can solve this through sites that try to grab and aggregate some of the great posts and sort of translate them into another language? This is definitely going to be one of the themes that comes up again and again, and I thank you for bringing it up.
Yeah, just to add to that, I mean, I've been looking at Chinese blogs, both English language and Chinese language, you know, separately. And one thing I noticed is that there are, you know, the Chinese bloggers who are blogging in English are saying kind of things to the Western world that the Western world is interested in. But the conversation going on the Chinese blogs is completely different. And if English speakers knew what a lot of the Chinese bloggers were saying, they might be quite surprised and shocked, and that's not being joined, you know. So in how, as a bridge blogger, and this is, I think, coming back to our session as well, how do bridge bloggers help to facilitate that conversation? Because in the Chinese cyberspace, there's a lot of anti-Americanism, there's a lot of anti-Japanese, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on that the English-speaking world doesn't hear about. And I think that, you know, relations between these kind of different worlds would be better if people in these different worlds understood why people in these worlds think the way they do, and why people in China might have certain opinions about Americans that Americans are not aware of, for instance. But how do you bridge that in a constructive way? Is something I don't think we've solved at this point.
One of the things I'm noticing, I guess it shouldn't be such a bad problem that people are blogging like in Swahili and that nobody else can read them. Because for me, what's interesting is that the first time I'm reading something written in Swahili by young people that's relevant to me as a Kenyan, and that seeing people use tools in Swahili and give commentary in Swahili, whereas before everything that was written in Swahili was, you know, old and archaic and sort of like old school people. And it's important as especially for Kenyans who are based in the diaspora, where we don't have access to things written in Swahili anymore, like newspapers. We don't listen to it as much before. For me, reading a blog in Swahili, I mean, it's incredible. It feels good. But like one of the, somewhere like Kenya where most of the people speak English, one of the guys who's blogging is like, he tried to get his friends in Kenya to read his blog in Swahili, and they're like, oh, we don't even understand a lot of what you're writing, because people have become so used to English as a form of communication online. I don't know what the future is. I don't know how many people will actually be reading Swahili blogs. Some people read my blogs from Europe with translate, like I get hits from Google Translate. So maybe more tools that can translate the blogs would be one way to go. But.
Yeah. I learned about this watching the Iranian world, where in Iraq, Zayed, who's a friend of Omar's, who was my bridge to them, it just emailed me a few days ago saying that he wants to blog in Arabic now because it is so important to make it spread. But there's also the benefit of blogging in English because it gets the story out. And when I first discovered Hoder's blog and Sina Motalebi was arrested as a blogger in Tehran, Hoder and Pedram, another friend of his who was here, started, if I'm a right Hoder, started asking other bloggers who spoke English, start telling your story in English because the story is getting out. And that's important too. So they're both important. They both have reasons. I think the way it's going to spread to the people is unquestionably, and I'm so excited about having tools in the native languages because that's going to make it spread. It belongs to the people then. But then there's also the ability to translate so we can have the bridges and understand people, and also the ability to translate so you get the story out to media too, which is important as well.
Yeah. Jeff, if you'll pass to Jonathan Pizer behind you.
Can I announce something? Mm-hmm. I just made a wiki page for all the courses in this, so everybody can register so we can have wiki
on each other. Okay, what's the wiki?
Voter.com/globalvoices.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Fabulous.
I just want to recount a personal experience and ask about this related to language. My wife is Japanese, and she works for a Japanese firm. And very often she'll come back to me and talk about certain frustrating things at work. And she says to me, you know, there are some things that I say, I said it in English because I could say it in English, and I couldn't say it in Japanese. So I'm wondering, because she has different conversations in her native language than she does in English. So while on the one hand, what we really want to do is have localized language because then you get a larger audience within the country. And it would be nice to translate so people know what's going on in the local languages. I'm wondering if it's still very important to have that separation because you're having different conversations in the different languages and they're culturally specific as well.
Just at a random chance, I would love to see a show of hands for people who blog in two languages. So that's a decent number of folks here. How about people who are blogging only in one language?
The rest.
Okay.
I should try and blog in
Chinese. Yeah, no, it would be interesting to see you blog in Chinese.
It's interesting. This morning we were talking about the Spirit of America blog. Translation came up a couple of times, and how are we going to do it? And I think, you know, you're right, the conversation in one language is different than the others, but we still need to get the word out. You know, you look at, we have Dave Weiner here, sort of the father of RSS. Maybe it's time for us to sort of rally around a standard where a permalink becomes something that the world can translate and we can relate, you know, one original message out to a bunch of different languages using some standards we already have today. You know, well, you think of an item that's been blogged has a permalink, which is an ID number.
I see.
So if someone somewhere else translates that, just like a track back now, you know, can we translate back? Maybe is what we should be, the movement we should be trying to create so that people around the world, not just comment, can translate back. And so that's the next session. We can
that
all get together
overhead.
And try to solve that. And we can discuss that over drinks later on tonight, Dave.
It sounds like a great tool set.
So definitely.
Let's make sure we talk about that in our session after lunch because our tool sets discussion hopefully will deal with a lot of these technical issues.
Do you want to get in? I want to bring Matt into the dialogue.
I found what's been said here about blogging in English very Anglo-centric. When you look, but only if the story gets out when it goes into English. Well, yes and no. Like when Rebecca said about anti-Japanese sentiment in Chinese blogs. If a Chinese could blog in Japanese, I mean Japanese in Chinese, and talk to each other, it would be much more interesting than doing it via English. Or same with Iraq and Iran, I think would have lots of interesting things to discuss. So I'm not sure that English is the only second language we should be thinking about.
So an interesting project that got started and has not gotten an enormous amount of traction, but it's sort of interesting as one that's thinking about it, is a project called Blogalization. And the idea behind it was to identify posts in one language that could be interesting in any number of languages. So essentially saying, here's an interesting post in Polish. We'd really like to see this not only in English, but also in Spanish and French, so on and so forth, with the hope that a group of people could start specializing instead of crossing over between those different languages in one fashion or another. Is this directly on that?
Yeah, about localization is...
Does anybody have problems with that? Because I've seen some great stuff in Mexican and South American blogs that I've wanted to put up on localization, but I hesitated because I didn't know if someone would feel okay with me just translating it. Because I mean, everyone translates in their own way, and I thought maybe some people would have problems with that.
So let's hold on this for just half a second because I want to complicate this discussion even further and sort of get some other perspectives on bridging involved with it. So. I want to bring Matt into the discussion. I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about some of the bridges that you've been trying to build with military blogging work.
Okay. First of all, note to self, never follow Omar and Mohammed. Write that down. These guys are fantastic. My blog, black5.net, originally wasn't intended to be an activist blog, and I never thought about activism in terms of a military blog or a mil blog, until I started having conversations about Global Voices Online, and then the realization came to me that actually I am somewhat of an activist. Military blogs in general are relatively new. There's been a few for a couple years. I've been around for about a year and a half. And there are some inherent problems with blogging, and most of us tend to use pseudonyms or we try to maintain our anonymity. Basically because there's some challenges we face in terms of being critical of our commander-in-chief or some of our leaders. That's one issue that we face. The other is security issues. And then finally, there's some things that we're also restricted about talking about. So, for instance, in 2000, I signed an agreement that said I wouldn't talk about certain things that I had done in the military for 7 years or my lifetime. So I've got about 66 more years to go. And as funny as that sounds, that's a reality we face. The other issue we face, since we're all tend to be use pseudonyms, is legitimacy and understanding, verification of actually what happens out there. So basically, my blog started off as trying to highlight some of the stories that the mainstream media has missed or focused on, and Omar Mohammed put that quite eloquently. But there's just, quite frankly, so many things out there that are happening that there's good things that are happening as well as bad. And I'd like to say that I think the bad things are relatively minor compared to the enormous good. And so one of the things that I started off doing was trying to focus on some of the good things that are happening out there. I realized right away, and I wasn't aware of this. My wife has told me this many times, but I didn't know. The military, we have our own language, too. For instance, in a conversation, I might say we're going to set up an LPOP two clicks forward of the flot, and I don't know if anybody in this room really knows what I'm talking about. It took a couple of weeks before I realized that I wasn't communicating quite clearly.
This could be another use for machine translation.
Yes.
We're going to have to start something AI to work on that.
And I have to point out that I am, my blog is absolutely not a standout at all. There's about 100 and so military bloggers out there right now that are part of a group called Mil Blogs. There's a ring that was started by the MudvilleGazette.com. And I am here because basically now I'm a civilian and I can actually travel and I have time to be here. But so anyway, back to the audience piece is that if you really want to, and everybody here obviously knows this, if you want to maximize your reach, we were talking about blogging in English to get to the Western world and get your stories out. It's the same way with the military. I had to change some of the ways I was writing in order to reach that audience. And then from there, the blog sort of grew, and that's where the activism piece started happening. It could be anything from raising money to help wounded soldiers who are coming back from Iraq, to working with the Spirit of America, to many different things. And so from there it grew. And one of the things that I also learned along the way was that in order to facilitate action, and again, I never thought of myself as an activist, but this sort of just kind of inherently evolved that way, it was to make it easier for people to get involved. So for instance, there's an item that was up for a vote in Ohio called the Ohio Patriot Plan that was protecting Ohio veterans while they're away overseas, protecting their homes from foreclosure and things like that. it was an important bill to pass. And so what I would do is I would put the emails of all the folks that were going to vote on it in committee, along with maybe some talking points to mention, but not a blueprint for what people would write, because then obviously it would seem like a spam letter. And so sort of facilitate action that way, or raising money for Spirit of America, or like I said, wounded soldiers coming back from Iraq. So that was another piece to it. And so actually on my blog, a couple weeks ago, I said, you know, military bloggers as activists, and about half people said, no, you're not. And then, you know, after a certain conversation, you know, actually we are. The other issue, too, is that the military community is quite large and quite spread out. Aside from the 2 million or so people in the U.S. military, there's folks like me that are veterans, spouses, parents, children, that have an enthusiasm for it. And it's quite large. And I was actually quite overwhelmed by the response that we've all had. So the community sort of spread out, and I think at first, I think I want to say back in August of 2003, there might have been four or five of us just getting started on the Milblog ring, and now, like I said, there's over 100 or so. There's also, you know, questions of government censorship. We talk about that on our blogs quite often, what we can say, what we can't say. Some blogs have been shut down by soldiers that were actually in Iraq. So we face these kind of issues. My blog was actually blocked in Iraq by the U.S. military just because they use WebSense. And so it took me a couple days, and thanks to the Mudville Gazette, we actually figured out that if I contacted WebSense itself, they maintained a list of things they blocked, and we were able to unblock it. But so there's a lot of challenges we overcame to try to communicate between people that are overseas and back here in the States.
Great, fantastic. Do we have any questions for Matt? Sort of a conversation dialogue here. Great.
I have a question about the Milblog. I've been collecting pictures of. Hello?
It's recording. But then you have to shout
I've been collecting some of the pictures of the from the Milblogs, basically, trying to see what the life is like on the other side. I try to imagine what it's really like, and we've gotten some journalists, freelancers, came and then show some slides. But my question is more about what do they censor? I mean, how mundane does it get? And that's what I like to know, actually. I mean, I see a lot of the what I imagine is that my starting point is somewhat of my own legacy coming from Korea. Like, we heard a lot about the war stories, but this war is very, very different from the war that we experienced in Korean Peninsula. In terms of firepower, kind of machinery is being used to fight the war. So I'm very interested in that because that helps me sort of imagine how you know, what it's like.
Okay, well, that's a great question. Actually, that's probably, I would say, one of probably the biggest reasons that people come to a Milblog is actually to get a better flavor of what actually it's like to be in the military or even to be in combat. In terms of censorship, it really depends on your chain of command or the officers that are over you. And in some cases, they're quite open with what you can blog about as long as you're forthcoming about the fact that you actually have a blog. When you tend to get into trouble is when you give away what's called operational information. So, for instance, that could be how a convoy is driven, a route you might use, or something else that could be used to attack that group of soldiers. So that's really where the censorship comes in. It's not so much that, you know, of course the military is going to be worried about its image, and they're going to be worried about negative press, and why wouldn't they? But it tends to be an operational issue. I have a series on my blog called Someone You Should Know, and it highlights it's in the index, and it highlights just average people that are doing different things. And it's not all military people. There's actually, I have a German a German worker in Landstuhl that talks to our wounded, visits our wounded from soldiersangels.com. There's many, many stories. There's stories about an Iraqi translator. There's some other things, but that highlights what they do, and it sort of gives a flavor about what it's like to be in the military, and I think that's what a lot of people, you know, are interested in terms of, you know, they read about things in the media, but they really want to know what it's really like.
Specifically, I heard about the casualty figure that has to do with the neurological damages. There are a lot of people, like in possibly in thousands, who are in a vegetative state because we have such an excellent medical care. Do you know anything about that? Like people who are completely neurologically damaged so that they are like in coma in thousands, lingering around in Germany and stuff like that.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's not in the thousands, but typically, this is sort of a side note, and maybe we could talk over lunch or something about some of these things. But one of the differences between this war and wars in the past is the body armor is exceptional. And so what happens is instead of soldiers dying, they lose limbs or an eye or suffer some other kind of catastrophic event, but their internal organs are okay. Typically what will happen is when a soldier has an event like that in Iraq or Afghanistan and they're flown to Germany, they're put in a drug-induced coma. You know, in order to keep them stable, and then sometimes flown to Walter Reed Hospital in D.C. So typically what I would say is we'd probably have thousands more dead if it wasn't for the fact of the body armor and the protection that we have, and that this is causing a lot more amputees and some of the other things. But as far as having thousands in a comatose state, I don't think that's accurate at all. I'd be pretty sure that it's not.
Other questions for Matt?
Matt, what stories, if any, do you have of military bloggers and civilian bloggers in country and the interaction of have friendships form? Have they understood more of each other? Got into arguments? What's the interaction?
All right, another good question. You know, the military tends to form the sort of a fraternal bonds, and it's one reason some people are attracted to it. And I would say in terms of blogging, you know, people think they get to know each other through the way they write and the way they, you know, we email each other, things like that. And I would say that if anything, it's brought us a lot closer together. And one of the very interesting things about military blogs in general is that there is a huge inter-service rivalry, the Army and the Navy. For instance, we just had a football game you might have heard about where somebody else won. But the main thing is that even within the Navy, there's a rivalry between the submariners and the surface guys, and the Army between the paratroopers and the land guys. And so it's really important to try to get beyond that and expand in terms of the military as a whole. We all kind of go through the same things. This is sort of a boiling it down to a probably an incorrect level, but you know, we've all peeled potatoes. We've all done some of the same things, whether you're a cook on a ship or, you know, you're a paratrooper jumping out of a plane. We've had a lot of the similar experiences, and that's kind of brought us together. Civilians in Iraq it's another issue in terms of Iraq the Model. It's one of my favorite blogs. But, you know, I wouldn't say there's a whole lot of interaction between Iraqi civilians and the military bloggers, but there is between maybe American civilians that are working over there. And quite frankly, a lot of them are ex-military, so there's some energy behind that.
So that's actually a particularly interesting point, which is that in talking about bridging so far, and this actually gets a little bit back to Yerji's point, we're seeing a lot of bridging to America, it sounds like, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're seeing a lot of bridging between Iraqi civilians and Americans. We're seeing a decent amount of bridging between American military personnel and American civilians. I'd love to see if we can open up this conversation a little bit more, get it to be a bit more international, and that's why I'm going to get Jeff to put down his camera and put him on the spot and get him to talk a little bit about what's going on in Malaysia and his work there. So, yeah, in fact, please come down and we'll get you talking in front of the mic.
we never had wars in the last 47 years since we gained our independence from the British. And we have never changed our government in the last 47 years, too. There weren't any typhoons, there weren't any disasters, but bloggers are still whining away. Because we thought that the national agenda set forth by our prime minister of 22 years, who has just retired last year, saying that we have a deadline to leapfrog ourselves from a third world country to the first world without going through the second. So with 15 years left, running up to the year 2020, we're asking ourselves whether we are still doing the right thing, we are still doing the relevant things when we talk about leapfrogging the country into the first world. So that is where Malaysian bloggers are starting to question. Is our governance model going by that direction? And blogs in Malaysia, it's a new movement, but it's not something that is very new, because we thought that it's just a natural progression from the 1996 model where you have GeoCities, you have Tripod, and so on. But the distinct difference could possibly be that you add your personal context, you add nuances onto the things that you write from very upfront and personal perspective. So that's how it started. And a lot of bloggers around town in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia are basically centered around the national capital, Kuala Lumpur. And most of them write in two languages, in our national language, Bahasa Malaysia, as well as English. And English has been the medium of instruction in all the three levels of our education system. So English is never something that is alien to us. We take the language like fish to water. So that is how we get to see two spheres within the blogosphere in Malaysia, people who write in Bahasa, and that is where they don't get their stories out, they don't get connected through the blogosphere out of Malaysia. And I think that is something that we need to address later, because there's a lot of good stuff being written in Bahasa Malaysia, but it's drowned because they never get noticed. They are not Googleable in the first place. And so that is what has been going on. So in Malaysia, blogs has been put on the spotlight in the last 2 years, because a few of the so-called pioneers, me included, that we have started to look at how we can tap onto the XML as well as the RSS feed, so that all the bloggers will have to send their RSS feed to an aggregator, which we call petalingstreet.org. Petaling Street is the confluence of the river that created Malaysian civilization. And that's a place foreigners and local people congregate to get fake Rolex and to get Gucci clothing. So that is where we branded ourselves, the petalingstreet.org. That's it. So we aggregate this, and we have discovered that within two years, we have aggregated some 8,000 blogs in two languages. And this petalingstreet.org get to see quite a lot of burnout rate, as well as people who came in for a short while and then they disappeared. So the attrition rate is quite high, no doubt about it. But that is where we get to divide this into two sections. Section one would be the people who were the pioneers who conceptualized on this, to have a common place for all the bloggers to come in together. And that is the idea behind this project. Because we thought that the blogging world is not going to work if you are doing it all alone. We need to really hold hands with the newcomers, and that's how we get all the newcomers to have a chance, have your 15 seconds of fame. That's how we did. And that is on a macro basis. On the micro basis, you have this concept of multimedia super corridor in Malaysia. We like to emulate what Silicon Valley has done, has been so successful. And that is the showcase of Malaysian migration towards technology and ICT. And And within that MSC, which is basically a 50 by 15 kilometers geographical space, there's this township called Subang Jaya, and that's the place where I stay. You get to see the highest rate of PC penetration, the highest rate of internet penetration, and also the highest rate of broadband penetration. And we try to put as if you are throwing a ball onto a court and let the people play, if possible, we'll push the goalposts further from time to time. So we did that since 1999, and it's available at usj.com.ny. It is a grassroots community a website. We talk about a lot of things that concern the quality of life of this knowledge society called Subang Jaya. And one of those things that we question hard is that though Malaysia has gained independence and formed its nationhood based on a democratic process, we have three tiered of government. The first one is the federal government. We elect the government into office, and we have the state-level government. But the third tier of the government is basically where things, where local development are happening, and that is the government which used to be elected, but it has been abolished since 1969 due to some political heritage and so on. So we try to question this. A lot of things that have gone wrong in terms of governance happen at the third level of the the governance itself. So we are trying to question a lot of things. And of course, you get to see people getting very jittery over grassroots questioning in public manner on things that have gone wrong. Rubbish did not get collected. Things that are a given in a first world country, but it is a big concern, and we are still trying to grapple with things like this, very basic needs. So this is where we have been doing since 1999, and it has been quite successful in the sense that we get a lot of people to come online and to share their views and opinions, likes and dislikes. So this website has gone on to win two major prizes, awards in Malaysia in the year 2000. And so we are doing it in three level as far as using internet as a driver for change. From the micro community perspective, that is USJ, from the personal perspective, we have lots of bloggers who blog in their own languages as well as their likes and dislikes. And the third level is, of course, the Blogosphere Unite model, that is Petaling Street. So we try to create in a country where broadband penetration is barely 1% of the national population to try to do these three things. Perhaps we won't stop short at three. We like to do more. But this is how we got started, and we are still sustaining it. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks, Jeff. Questions for Jeff? Does anyone want to start off with questions for Jeff, or do I get to start off with questions for Jeff? Ari, are you jumping in?
Actually, questions for both him and for Omar and Muhammad. What percentage of the readers of maybe the English-based blogs are in Malaysia? And what percentage of your readers are in Iraq?
Basically, in Malaysia, because English is quite a lingua franca.
Mike, please.
So, yeah. I'm so sorry. Since English is so popular and recognizable as a language of communication in Malaysia, so we do not have any problem as far as the language barrier. But if you were to quantify that, I think more than 90% are reading serious blogs which are written in English, yeah.
Are they in Malaysia, most of the readers in Malaysia, or do you have...
I can't say for the entire blogosphere in Malaysia, but as far as my tracking of the statistics of the visitors concerned, some 70% comes from Malaysia itself, but 30% are basically... it's a common sign-on page for every breakfast that they will have to log in and then they see what is happening in Malaysia. And basically, these are the people who are either students in their 20s who are studying in Australia, Canada, Australia, as well as in America. And some of them come from United Kingdom. These are the few countries of choice when our people go overseas for tertiary education. And you also have Malaysians who are working overseas, who locked in, and that's the common signing place for them to look for news which are not reported in the mainstream media. And I think that we have created an impact in that we are the alternative media that people believe in.
So Jeff, that's really useful in as much as, you know, we're getting a sense that with the community that you're working with, 70% is already in Malaysia, but then beyond that, a lot of the readers who are outside of Malaysia are Malaysians, are interested in Malaysian news in one fashion or another. And this is sort of one of a whole set of blogs like this. I'm very involved, oddly enough, I know I don't look Ghanaian, but I'm very involved with the Ghanaian diaspora community in the United States. And there's a site, GhanaWeb.com, which has probably 80% foreign readership, but it's almost all Ghanaians. So it ends up being a Ghanaian community, except for the fact that it ends up being international. For you guys with Iraq the Model, do you have a sense for what percentage of that readership is Iraqi, what percent is American? How does that end up breaking out?
Unfortunately, the percentage of Iraqi readers from inside Iraq is low. But I believe that there are more Iraqis from outside Iraq, especially from you know, living in America or Europe, are reading the blog, because I receive too many emails and comments from Iraqis who are outside Iraq. But mainly, I think that more than 80% from the readers are in America.
Okay. Other questions for Jeff, or actually for any of our other speakers? We're going to take coffee break in about 10 minutes, so let's get some more questions in on this topic.
I was in Malaysia this past July, it was, and something that I noticed about the blogs there is it seemed to me about 90% of them were written by Chinese writers and not Malay writers. And it seemed like Malay writers were really underrepresented in Malaysia. And I think that's true around the world, that minorities in countries, and I don't think Malays are minorities in Malaysia, but in general, minorities in countries aren't being represented in the blogosphere as much as majorities are, and wealthier classes.
I think the observation is quite true and accurate in the sense that the bloggers who get noticed tend to come from the non-Malays, and Malays being the 67% majority in the country. But I think one of the reasons why Malay bloggers do not get noticed is because they are not Google-able. That's one. Number two is that there has been an occasion. There was a blog run by an expatriate in Hong Kong. His name is Phil, and he has a blog called flyingchair.org, based in Hong Kong. And he ran a sort of a blog, a best of the blogs from each country. And the most popular blogs came from Malaysia happened to be a blog written by a Malay and written in the national language, his Sultan Muzaffar, a very young person who talks about films, who talks about arts, but sometimes he does social criticism. But that is where bloggers who write in Bahasa Malaysia, good stuff, but do not get noticed because of the language when we put that in the international context.
Yeah, I have a question. Why are bloggers in Bahasa Malaysia not being picked up by Google?
Well, most of the blog, the content engine, if I can say that, they are using Blogspot. Or
what character
is the same as the English characters, yeah.
Searching in Bahasa Malay, and that's why they're not finding it? Or are the Blogspot blogs not getting very well indexed by Google?
Well, I think I don't have definitive answers for all this, but I do have a hunch. The hunch is this, that most of the blogs that are publicized
especially in the mainstream media, are basically those blogs which are written in English. And once it gets published, there is a replica of these articles that are printed in newspaper that are available online. And I think that helps in the top the page ranking.
Other questions?
Okay. At a risk of, I don't think this even works, does it?
Speak up. No, it's only for recording, so
you just
help us get it on tape.
Well, I think I'm going to be labeled as a skeptic, but I'm going to say it. I'm thinking about the metaphor of bridge, and for me, who comes from San Francisco, bridges are plentiful there, and the assumption of using the bridge is that there are two level grounds that are being bridged, and it seems to me that that is not the case with the internet. If you're looking, what are you bridging? Are the playing grounds the same? Are the power relations the same across the world? For example, even if people have access to Iraq, I'm wondering if everyone, as you said, has equal access. I'm sure that is stratified by gender, by education. Can people even operate a computer? In Iran, for example, I know that at most, out of 68 million people, 3 to 4 million have access to computers, to internet, not even computers. And that raises the question of, well, are blogs becoming kind of perhaps a replica of the uncritical pluralism that is so prevalent in the U.S.?
And then Janet also had a question, I think.
This is kind of picking up on that issue as something I was thinking about before you said it. But I think that we have an opportunity to look at bridges in a lot of ways. And a lot of what we talked about now are bridges within countries or across countries of literate people. And I was talking with a school principal in South Africa in a poor section of Cape Town who they wanted to study history. And so the history books were not that good because they were from the former regime. And so they looked at oral history, and they had the children talk to their parents and grandparents about what it was like in apartheid. And they had, the grandparents and the parents were mostly non-literate, but they had them come to class as historians, as guest speakers. And the children would transcribe what they were doing. So I think there's a lot of opportunity here for us to reach back across generations and across people who are not literate, but to record what they're doing and then share that with the rest of the world.
I'm going to seize it for half a second. One of the discussions that's happened in the past when we've talked about global blogging has focused exactly on this, which is how do we get around literacy barriers? One of the things that I've found that has been a really interesting obstacle to getting people blogging in West Africa is the fact that where these conversations take place is already on talk radio. Hoder talked yesterday about going from taxi cab conversations, literally people in the back of a taxi cab talking politics instead of bringing it online into the blogs. Right now in Ghana, you would have a really hard time convincing people that it's worth bringing that conversation online and making it written just because that conversation happens to be so good in the talk radio space. But in a space where these voices otherwise aren't being heard, oral histories, this becomes a really interesting project. And as we start thinking about how you bring blogging out into different communities, Hoder, actually, I'm wondering if you could talk about this idea of getting people putting their journals from years back online in Iran.
I've had this project, I've recently been thinking about it, that, and I'm going to talk about it in detail, that this I have an idea of blogging the old diaries of pre-revolutionary Iranian diaries. So people, the young generation can understand what had happened in the same streets, in the same cities, when I don't want to defend the kingdom, or I'm not a monarchist or anything, but I just want to show the young people that
this country hasn't always been like this. So their expectations would be a little bit higher. We'll talk about some of these projects later in my session.
Awesome. We've got time for maybe one, two more comments before we break, session break.
This question is for both Jeff and for Mohammed. About the question I have is how the blogging community interacts with the quote-unquote professional or mainstream journalists that are in the country. In other words, is there interplay between them? Is there any sense in more mainstream news sources that there's a challenge to journalism? Is there any discussion about that locally? I mean, in local languages.
So let's actually start with Mohammed and Omar on that one.
I think this is one of the problems in Iraq, that the blogosphere in Iraq is still newborn, and so is the media itself. And that's why none of them has established any interaction with each other. They still don't know each other. The media even doesn't know, the Iraqi media doesn't know that there is something that like blogs. Uh-huh. Yeah. So I think it needs time. Maybe some news websites, Iraqi news websites, they link to some blogs, but I never seen them quote from them. I believe it takes time until people get to know in Iraq get to know the blogs more. And I think when blogs in Arabic will appear, I think this will attract more attention to the blogs that are in English, because I expect the number of blogs in Arabic to be much more higher than the number of blogs in English. And I think this will bring attention to the rest of them.
So Jeff, let's let you get in here.
Yeah, I think I have an experience to relate to. The love-hate situation between old media and new media, that the pre-media versus the bloggers and so on. And one of those things that has erupted in Malaysia in the past 2 years is that suddenly you see bloggers from petalingstreet.org, suddenly they gain prominence because they are technology editors and journalists who are keeping track and monitoring very closely on what has happened mainstream, and their mainstream is basically in the United States. And blogs has taken by storm in the United States as far as presidential elections concerned, as far as a lot of things that are being done on the blogosphere. So we took that as a sample model, and technology editors, especially in Malaysia's most highly circulated newspaper, has put it on the front page several times. And that casts a lot of uneasiness among the mainstream media editors, and especially among editors of the government-controlled newspapers. And that's where I had a close shave 2 months ago, that we were talking about moving forward the country. And we have a new prime minister who has pledged that he is going to fight head on big time against corruption. And blogger from Screenshot said that corruption and the Islamic way, and Malaysia has got its model of Islam. It's called Islam Hadari. So if you are talking about fighting corruption, at the other time you want to promote the universal values of Islam Hadari, then these two things, these two elements, corruption and Islam Hadari, should be like oil and water. They shouldn't mix. And it was distorted, and because there was somebody who used a name in a pseudonym which relates to the former, the fallen Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim. He used the word, the name Anwar, and I criticized that. No, that was a wrong way of analogy, equating Islam Hadari and corruption as being water and all that do not mix. And he said he went on the expletive, and the entire pressure, the whole works of the legal system fell on the blogger. That was me, and I was threatened with imprisonment without trial. So one of the ways that I unentangle myself out of this entire threats, it went on the front page of the best-selling Bahasa Malaysia newspaper for 4 days.
that kind of pressure. So one of those things that I untangled myself is to ask them, do not mislead your readers. What has been said was not the work of the blogger, and you have said it wrongly. Blogs are not website. Website are not blogs. Blog can be a website, but website can never be a blog. And that confuses them, because they do not know what blogs really are. And that the main, I thought that the main agenda behind this flaring up and inflammatory reporting in the mainstream media is to arouse the grassroots discontent. But the grassroots were confused. They do not have a notion about blogs, especially those Bahasa Malaysia speaking readership. So that's where I got away with murder.
So we're going to give Rebecca the last word in this session.
Okay. This has been fascinating, and I think one thing that's really interesting is that blogs as a tool are being used in different ways in different countries. And in Malaysia, it's coming up as this challenge to the internal media and a real alternative voice in Malaysia. In Iraq, it's more the voice of ordinary Iraqis speaking to the outside world. With Iran, it's having yet another function. The blogospheres are developing differently in different countries and are having different types of conversations, which is really interesting. And this is why it's so great that people can share experiences of how things are developing in different ways in different places. One, I was looking online, and I couldn't find it, but Isaac Mao had drawn a very interesting chart at one point about how the conversation goes sort of between the English language blogosphere and the Chinese language blogosphere. And unfortunately, I was Googling around looking for it. I couldn't find it. But I just want to bring this up, interestingly, because this comes back to our whole sort of topic for this session, which is bridge blogging. And in that chart, it was sort of the direction of information flows between the English language blogs and the Chinese. And it was all unidirectional. The Chinese bloggers were linking to all this stuff from the English language blogosphere and relaying it to the Chinese speakers. And then the Chinese speakers were all talking about it on the Chinese blogs and then talking about all their own stuff. And almost nothing was going back out the other way. No news from the Chinese blogosphere was making it back into the English language conversation. And so while we're going to be talking more in the next session, Ethan will talk about this more, about building your own blogosphere, I'd like to continue this question of bridging as we continue on in our sessions as well, and how you get that conversation going in a more equal to or multi-directional, not just because as someone pointed out, it's not just English and the local language. It's, you know, maybe Chinese and Japanese, but how you get this cross-border, cross-language discussion going, how you get the news coming from a local blogosphere out into the rest of the world. So.
In other words, we've still got a lot of work to do on this subject, not to mention all the other ones. We're going to take a break until 5 minutes after 11. When we reconvene, we're going to be learning at the feet of the masters, specifically Ori and Isaac and Hoder. This should be a lot of fun. So see you back in 10 minutes. Thanks, everybody. Great.